Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today. It's midday on the media. My guest is Kimmy Yoshino. Last month, she resigned as the founding editor of our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. She had assembled what has grown to be the largest newsroom in the state of Maryland, which includes a team that won the Pulitzer Prize this year for local reporting. Next week, she will become a managing editor at the Washington Post, overseeing features, sports, local news, investigations, and data. Kimmy Yoshino joins me here in Studio B. It's good to see you.
Nice to see you.
And congratulations on a very successful tenure in 3+ years at the Baltimore Banner.
Thank you so much.
You broke a lot of hearts.
I know.
When you made the decision to leave the Banner and go to the Post. How come?
I mean, I'll be honest. I broke mine a little, too. I felt like the Banner was in a great place. In my mind, there's no question of its future. There's no question of its sustainability. It is here to stay. The Post will also be here to stay. In what form, I don't know, but it's undergoing some challenges right now. And the drive to help be part of the solution and the future there was really calling to me.
So the Post is a fixer-upper. And I mean, is that fair?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it is a little bit. I think it's gone through a rough year. But to call it a fixer-upper, it's got dozens, hundreds of talented journalists. And every day I pick it up and I think, wow, that's another scoop they just had. So fixer-upper might be a little strong. It's definitely, needs a fresh coat of paint.
Is there stuff that you've learned to do at the Banner as a complete startup? I mean, you started with like no pencils and paper. Is there things that you've learned in these last few years that will inform what you're going to do at a place that has a storied history like the Post?
I think among the lessons are to not be afraid to take chances, take risks, not be afraid to try to do something differently. And also, if something's not working, stop doing it.
What would you count among your biggest accomplishments?
At the Banner?
I mean, I know what I would count.
Yeah.
But they may not be the same list.
I mean, I think when we first got here, people were not sure whether to take us seriously. And they didn't know whether we were a flash in the pan. And for me, I think the biggest accomplishment is establishing a newsroom and a report in Maryland that has become a must read and often the first read for the most powerful people in the state and every other person that wants to know what's going on.
Is there anything, there must be some things left undone. There's stuff undone for a lot of folks. I mean, do you have any sense that there's stuff you wish you could tidy up before you had to take off? Obviously, the opportunity at the Post is the opportunity, and the timing of that is what it is. But any unfinished business?
I think one of the great joys of the job has been getting to work so closely with reporters and getting to work on really exciting, interesting, impactful stories. And there are more of those in the pipeline that I am really excited about. The beauty of the Banner and the beauty of Baltimore is that there's this never-ending supply of exciting stories. And so I don't know if I would have ever felt that my work was done, because I think there would have always been another amazing story. I probably would have liked for us to have hit that break-even mark. I think that is probably a couple years away.
So let's talk about that. The viability of the idea that Stu Bainum had when he committed, a very, very significant sum of money, $50 million over 5 years, to get the newsroom off the ground. It's one of the largest nonprofit startups and journalism in the country, if not the largest. What is that break-even point right now? As I understand it, you have about 64,000 paying subscribers. What should that number be?
Yeah, as I was leaving, it was actually 66,000. So that number just literally ticks up every week. I think the goal is probably closer to 100. The actual number is sort of a sliding scale depending on how many people have taken that dollar offer, how many are converting into monthly subscribers.
Right. You can start at a dollar a month or whatever, a dollar a week, and then after a while you have to start paying, you know, market rates for it. Any conjecture as to why it's been slower than you had hoped when you initially, you know, put this on the back of the envelope 4 years ago? You thought you'd be at 100 by now.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we thought we would be here now or soon. I think things are going exactly as we had planned. The truth is we have expanded the newsroom. The newsroom is 85 journalists as I was leaving with ambitions to head into Montgomery County. We had expanded more significantly into Anne Arundel and Howard counties. So I think every time we made a decision to bring on more staff, to go deeper in other areas, to be more regional, that obviously has added to the bottom line, right? It adds more staff. It adds, you know, it adds more of that. So I think all of these decisions have been strategic and conscious. I don't really think that it means we're behind. I think it just means the banner has these huge ambitions, and this is all part of, you know, part of putting that path to sustainability together.
Let me ask you, because I clearly don't know, I have no idea, but did the fact that you haven't reached that benchmark, that, you know, the progress towards the 100,000 subscribers is slower than you might want to be, did that influence your decision to leave?
Not at all. I have no concerns about the future of the banner, and it didn't play into my thinking because it didn't feel like we were off course. We are steadily growing revenue, steadily growing subscribers, steadily growing audience. The banner is in a great, strong position.
So Stu Bainum, as I mentioned, made this 5-year commitment. That commitment's up in 2026, if I'm doing the math right. I mean, this all started in 2021. So the 5 years is up in 2026. That's a year from now. You're confident that if the money from Stuart Bainum stops being infused financially as a business operation, it'll be okay?
Yeah, I think that a couple things. One, Stuart Bainum is committed to the banner. He is its founder, he is its benefactor, and he is he believes deeply in the banner's mission and in what we're trying to do. I don't think he's going anywhere. That said, I have told the newsroom, do not take this for granted, right? The banner, so I'm still calling it we, even though I'm gone a couple weeks, but the banner needs to work like its life depends on it to make itself sustainable. The journalists need to think about the stories they're doing and make sure that they're reporting on issues that people need and want and are willing to pay for.
Your relationship with Stuart Bainum, by all appearances, seems to be very strong. I mean, you two got along great. He was thrilled that you agreed to take the job when you first talked about it. What was your relationship like with Patrick Soon-Shiong, who took over the LA Times about, two or three years before you left? And do you have a relationship with Jeff Bezos? Did you speak with him about this job, or were you only talking to the folks in the newsroom?
Yeah. On the Patrick Soon-Shiong front, I feel like I had a very good relationship with both Patrick Soon-Shiong and his wife, Michelle, who was very involved in some of the issues that I was working with on the newsroom. However, they were not as present at the LA Times as Stuart is at the banner. So it's not the same relationship. I had dinner with the Soon-Shiongs. I had their phone numbers. I could call them. And it was a very professional relationship, but it wasn't the same level of closeness that the relationship was not the same as I had with Stuart. I did not meet Jeff Bezos. I met the publisher, Will Lewis, and I met many people in the newsroom, but I did not I did not meet Jeff Bezos.
As far as you know, did he have any input into your hiring?
I have no idea.
And does anything worry about Jeff Bezos? A lot of other people are worried about Jeff Bezos. Some 250,000 people have stopped subscribing to the Washington Post in large measure because they don't like the direction of the paper as they see it under the ownership of Mr. Bezos.
Yeah. As I was talking to the Post, obviously there was a lot of upheaval over the editorial pages, the lack of endorsement for a presidential candidate, and the change in leadership with an editorial page, an opinion editor. Those are not my areas of concern. I work in the newsroom. The news operation is different from the opinion pages. Is it concerning? A little bit. I think it's also the owner's purview. And as long as he's staying out of the newsroom, which by all accounts he has, I can live with it. I think also if you look at his long the tenure of his ownership, he has been a very good owner of the Washington Post. He has invested millions in it. And I think it's easy to forget some of that commitment.
It does appear, though, that his enthusiasm for investing anymore in the Washington Post is waning at best. There have been buyout offers. People have left. They haven't been replaced. He's clearly interested in cutting the payroll. The Post seems to me to be in a period of contraction rather than expansion. Unlike the Banner, which you have expanded from zero to 85 journalists in the newsroom, as I mentioned, it's the largest newsroom in the state right now. Going into a situation where contraction is the ambiance, what's that going to mean for the newsroom?
I mean, to be clear, my understanding is that the Post newsroom has, more than 800 journalists in it. That's a huge number by any measure. And tremendous journalism can be done with hundreds of journalists and a very deep bench. I think contraction will be different. It's how I've spent the vast majority of my career, other than the 3.5 years I was in Baltimore. So I know what that's like. I also know that change is often essential. And I think for those people who are concerned about ownership or concerned about the direction, this is an opportunity to make a personal and professional choice for themselves. And I'm really excited to be working with all the people who decide that they want to stay.
You gave a quote to the Banner, to Liz Bowie, who is one of the very first reporters you hired, who I happen to know is heartbroken that you're leaving, as are many other people over there. You said in the story that she wrote announcing your departure, it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to build a local news organization and try to prove that local news is sustainable. You seem pretty sanguine. You seem pretty optimistic that local news is sustainable. You mentioned expanding to Howard County, to Montgomery County. You already have reporters in Baltimore County. Obviously, you've been covering Baltimore City. What is the key to local news? And we'll talk about this a little later in the program with a fellow from Columbia who sort of specializes in teaching young journalists about local news. What makes you think it's sustainable?
Well, for one, there's very little of it around. And so University of Maryland did a study last year that showed news deserts in the state of Maryland. So there are huge swaths of the state that do not have local reporting. So I think from that standpoint, there's very little competition, number one. Number two, I think there is a utility for local news, for knowing what's going on and who to vote for, how to vote, knowing what the issues are, and knowing things like where to go eat. Our food coverage has been among our bigger successes at the Banner, and it's just because at the end of the day, people are looking for information for how to lead their lives.
There was a reporter for the Nieman Institute that compared the Post and the New York Times to like Bing and Google. is local news, because that's going to be one of your purviews at the Post. You're going to be the managing editor for local news. Is that a key to the Post's resurgence and you know, steadying that ship?
I think local news has to be an essential part of the Post's future. However, I think for the Post to succeed, it needs a much broader audience, right? To sustain a newsroom of that size, it needs to go well beyond D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. So it's a, I would not call, you know, I don't know that these are apples and apples comparisons.
Kimi Yoshino has recently left the Baltimore Banner as the platform's founding editor-in-chief. She will become a managing editor of the Washington Post next week. It's Midday on the Media. We'll have more with Kimi Yoshino on the other side of a quick break. We'll be joined by two journalists from the Columbia Journalism School, Margaret Sullivan and Juan Miguel Benitez. And before we go to a break, we pause to remember an icon in the profession of journalism, Bill Moyers. He was an intern, a campaign aide, and then a press secretary for Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s, and after that as the host of several PBS shows over many, many decades. He engaged, enlightened, and enlivened generations of Americans as he expertly and compassionately explored stories from a wide spectrum of topics while lifting the level of discourse in the public square for all of us. Bill Moyers died in New York last Thursday at the age of 91. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday with the mayor. Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott will join me to talk about recent police-involved shootings and new assignments for a couple of the deputy mayors and department heads. Plus, Maryland Secretary of Labor Portia Wu will stop by to talk about the latest employment numbers. The private sector added enough jobs to more than offset losses in the public sector in the month of May. That's kind of interesting. And J. Wynn Russick will review Julius Caesar at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. That's coming up tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday on the Media. We're talking about the future of local, national, and international journalism with Kimi Yoshino, the former editor-in-chief at the Baltimore Banner, who will become a managing editor of the Washington Post on Monday. We'll continue our conversation with Kimi Yoshino in a few minutes, but first, my next guest is Margaret Sullivan, a former ombudsman at the Post and the New York Times. She writes a column about the media for The Guardian, and she serves as the director of the Craig Newmark Center for Journalism, Ethics, and Security at Columbia Journalism School. I spoke with Margaret Sullivan yesterday. So, Margaret, thank you for your time. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
So, a recent Gallup poll says that trust in mass media among Americans, the lowest it's been in 50 years. Some 36% of Americans say that they have no trust whatsoever in television, newspapers, radio. How do we get that trust back? What's causing that, and how do we fix it?
So, Tom, I think one of the things that's going on is that we're so fractured in the way our media is set up right now. It's very polarized, just like the country is very polarized. And so I think that if you were to drill down on that a little bit, you might find a slightly different answer. Like, I don't trust the media, but I do trust my media, just kind of the way people sometimes feel about their members of Congress. You know, I don't trust Congress, but yeah, I kind of like this guy who represents the district that I'm in. But, you know, in terms of sort of how to improve that, I think there are a number of things we can do. One of the things we can do is to tell our story a little bit better about how we do what we do. You know, how do reporters report a story? How do news organizations make decisions? We do a bad job of that. And I think that people don't really understand how we work, and it would help if they did a little bit more. I think we can be more transparent about the way we do things. The other thing that I think we can do is to be more trustworthy, you know, correct our errors when we make them, tell people what our purpose is. You know, when we make a mistake, when we make a misjudgment, you know, fess up. And I think that will help somewhat too. But in some ways, we're kind of into the whole problem of the rest of the country, which is that we're just so extremely split.
That's interesting, because do you think we're not fessing up enough? I mean, newspapers run corrections. I know on my program, if I make a mistake, the next day I get on the air.
That's because you're good, and you're talking about legit news organizations. But I actually use this as sort of a litmus test for whether a news organization or something that calls itself news is, you know, does have integrity and is valid. Do they correct their errors? And believe me, a lot of the things that pass for media, you know, whether it's a very partisan, you know, newspaper sounding thing that isn't really a newspaper, or whether it's a podcast, or whether it's an influencer, whatever that might be, you know, the errors may come and go. You could point them out and nothing will ever come of it. So to me, it is kind of a test of, are you for real or are you not? And do you have, I mean, to me, the most important thing is, do we have the public interest at heart? You know, we should not be driven by what drives, you know, what gets us the most clicks, or how can we get access to the powerful people? We should be driven by the public interest. And, you know, so that's a way that I like to judge whether a news organization has the public interest at heart. And believe me, as a former public editor of the New York Times and a former reporter myself, I know that it's no fun to correct your errors. It's no fun to have it pointed out, and it's no fun to say we got this wrong. But that's one of the ways that we tell kind of the good from the not so good.
Because I would imagine that the Trump administration probably would be the first to admit that the public interest, or their version of the public interest, is vastly different than the one you've just articulated. We've got in the White House press briefing room now seats reserved for influencers, for people from very far right, what the rest of the world sees as far right extreme media. Is there something that the mainstream media is missing, that the so-called mainstream media, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journals, the Washington Post, the NPRs of the world, that we're not doing to counter the narratives that are being developed and now, you know, joyfully disseminated by the White House itself?
Right. Well, you know, we have found that we can't really much affect the way the White House makes its decisions about who's going to get a seat, whether it's at the Pentagon or whether it's in the White House briefing room or someplace else. But, I mean, we have to tell the truth. You know, we have to seek out and tell the truth to the best of our ability. And if people prefer to get their information from, you know, an influencer, someone who's on YouTube, someone whose main medium is TikTok, you know, that is definitely happening. But many times that information that they're kind of opining on is actually coming from more traditional news organizations that are doing the reporting work. You know, again, I think we have to sort of get it across to people that the press, you know, maybe not the media, but the press is a very important part of democracy, and that we're not going to have a democracy without good reporting and, you know, brave news organizations that will choose to tell the truth. And, you know, I've been in the business for a long time. I'm still pretty idealistic about that.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the term media is so all encompassing these days that, you know, Lord knows what it means. You are at the nexus of not just media, but academia. You are in the second year of an appointment as the head of the Craig Newmark Center for Journalism, Ethics, and Security at the Columbia Journalism School. We've got universities like the one you work for, like Harvard University. We've got law firms. We've got media conglomerates or the parent companies thereof making deals with the right. Trump administration. You know, a lot of people think of it as extortion on behalf of the Trump administration. What's the answer there? I mean, How does Disney, you know, justify letting a lawsuit move forward as opposed to just paying a fee to the Trump Library to make the falderal with George Stephanopoulos go away? CBS right. is in the same spot. I mean, they're suing the Des Moines Register for a poll, for gosh sakes. How does that get countered effectively?
You know, it's been a really tough situation at Columbia where, you know, the Trump administration has said, unless you make the following changes, we're going to take your federal funding away, or we're going to take these grants away. And Columbia has, you know, kind of tried to negotiate through that. That's something they've done that other schools, you know, like Harvard has kind of been the other example of saying, no, you know, we're not going to capitulate in that way. It's a really tough thing. I mean, these are real jobs. They're real. It's really important research. But I think, you know, and I write about the media a lot. So let me talk about the decisions that some of the news organizations have made, like ABC, which you're mentioning that ABC was sued by Trump and they basically settled it. And settling it is in a way tantamount to saying, yeah, we did something wrong. I think it's really important to stand up and to, you know, again, we correct our errors when we're wrong, but if we're just being bullied, it's better, much better, to sort of stand firm. And I show as an example of doing it right, the Associated Press, which, you know, when the Trump administration said, oh, we've decided unilaterally, we're going to call the Gulf of Mexico, we're not going to use that term Gulf of Mexico anymore. We want all of you to say Gulf of America. And the Associated Press, which has a global audience, continued to use Gulf of Mexico, although mentioning, you know, that the Trump administration wants it called this, but still on first reference, as we say, calling it the Gulf of Mexico. And, you know, they were punished by the administration. They lost some of their access to, you know, going on Air Force One or having a seat in the briefing room or whatever it was. And they've, you know, the AP has stuck to their guns over it and they've sued over it. They won the first round, they lost the appeal, and now they're going back for more. But, you know, it's really hard to do that. And at the same time, you really can't have the government telling the press what to write. So I think it's really important to stand up on principle.
Margaret Sullivan, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Margaret Sullivan writes about the media for The Guardian. She's the director of the Craig Newmark Center for Journalism, Ethics, and Security at Columbia Journalism School. We spoke yesterday afternoon. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll continue this edition of Midday on the Media. Kimmy Yoshino, the founding editor-in-chief of our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, is with me here in Studio B. We'll be joined by Juan Manuel Benitez, a colleague of Margaret Sullivan's on the faculty of the Columbia Journalism School. He studies local reporting. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Before we continue Midday on the Media, I do want to tell you that the vote, by a vote of 51-50, the Senate has passed the reconciliation bill that Donald Trump refers to as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. It was a tie that J.D. Vance, the vice president, had to cast the tie-breaking vote in. The focal point in this process was Senator Lisa Murkowski, who's been in the Senate for 23 years. She's from Alaska. She exerted a lot of pressure and got a lot of breaks for people in her state and ended up voting for the legislation. It now goes back to the House. Punchbowl News reporting it faces an uncertain fate there. The core of the reconciliation bill hasn't changed since it was passed in the House on the 22nd of May, but Senate Republicans have approved cutting $1 trillion from Medicaid, and that's actually more than the House. So there could be some moderate House Republicans who are going to complain about the scope of the cuts to Medicaid. So the reconciliation bill back to the House, the self-imposed deadline, July 4th, that's coming up this week. So we will keep you posted here on WIPR and NPR. And if you've just joined us today, it's Midday on the Media. Kimmy Yoshina joins me here in Studio B. Last month, she concluded her very successful tenure as the founding editor-in-chief of our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. She'll take over as a managing editor of the Washington Post next week. And joining us on Zoom now is Juan Manuel Benitez. He's a professor of professional practice of local journalism at the Columbia Journalism School. He joins us from New York. Juan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Tom.
So I wonder if you had a chance to hear any of what Margaret Sullivan had to say in the last segment. In general, whether it be local news or national, international news, do you think that Margaret's contention that we as a profession need to be more self-critical, more transparent, and a little harder on ourselves is a solid argument? What do you think?
There's some we should be making that effort. Also, we should be trying to reconnect with our audiences and develop new audiences, because that's the only way local journalism is going to survive right now. I do believe that it's a great time for local journalism, and a lot of people are going to be surprised with that statement. But we have a lot of great reporting being done out there. We have award-winning journalism happening all over our country in local newsrooms. The only problem that we have right now is that we need to find our audience. So we need to reconnect. We need to develop a new trust. We need to develop loyalty with those audiences at a very difficult time of fragmentation of the media landscape, and at a very difficult time with attention from those audiences that are connected to information all day, but they might be getting information from influencers or social media or not reputable sources of information. So that is where the key is for us to reconnect. I think there's been way too much talk in the last few years about how to reinvent newspapers. And I think that the goal here is not to save newspapers, it's to save what newspapers, local newspapers, did for democracy. And we don't know exactly how that's going to look like in the next few years, but it might be try new ways of communicating, delivering the news, and creating new platforms and formats to recapture the attention of our audience.
And Kimmy Yoshina, at the Banner, you struggled with this a lot. You know, Margaret Sullivan has written in the Columbia Journalism Review that we've got a problem with news deserts. We also have a problem with information oceans, where we are bombarded and overwhelmed with the tsunami of news, particularly this tension between national and international news versus local news. I mean, Donald Trump, for all his benefits and you know, misgivings, is an attention genius, and he can suck the oxygen out of a newsroom pretty easily. How did you handle that at the Banner? What do you anticipate those challenges will be at the Post?
Yeah, I've often said that people know more about what Donald Trump is doing than they do what Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott is doing. You know, I think that so much of what has been said earlier on the show is true, which is, we have to find new ways to reach people. We have to find new platforms. At the Banner, we were very bullish on delivering news on video, on social video to audiences. I've often said that our Instagram and TikTok guy, Krishna, is probably the most recognizable journalist at the Banner. So I think that those are absolutely essential. At the Post, I think, you know, it's the same challenge on a different scale. Getting people's attention, making the news interesting, making people want to read it, being trustworthy and developing that relationship, developing habit. These are the existential questions that we all have. How to reach people, how to know who our audience is.
And Juan Manuel Benitez, there's also challenges, certainly on the national level, with this particular president who utters so many things that are just downright false. It's very difficult to discern what's actually true and what's actually being made up by him. He does make up a lot, but he's not the only one. I mean, I talk to local politicians and people in statewide office all the time on this show, and I've heard direct falsehoods uttered straight to me with a smile on their face. How do you train your students to report in an era where you can just make stuff up? And because it's coming from the highest office in the land, there are other people who feel at liberty to do that as well.
I mean, Tom, I'm shocked. Politicians lying? That's never happened.
Right.
So we're trying to basically train excellent reporters in the most classical way. At the end of the day, reporting hasn't changed. The art of reporting hasn't changed. What we have to focus on is how we communicate that information. How do we explain to our listeners or our readers or our viewers why what an elected official has said is not true, or where this falsehood is coming from, what these politicians are trying to do by saying a specific thing that doesn't match reality. So that's always important. We cannot forget about offering value to our audiences and offering a service, answers. And I think that's going to be key in the next few years because everybody out there, they are trying to find answers to everyday problems. That is a role that local newspapers used to fill every day, and now it's harder in many parts of the country and the world. And they're going now to ChatGPT, to other artificial intelligence services, asking questions about their everyday needs. And we do need to be there providing the key answers so they can go about their lives and they can be successful with their schooling, with their transportation needs in their cities, with who to vote for when it comes to local elections. So I do believe that in the next few years, and we've already seen this already, local newsrooms are going to partner with artificial intelligence companies to be able to provide high quality information that those AI companies need to keep their businesses afloat, because they have to answer those queries from their users.
And Kimi Yoshino, if you are a consumer of news, if you go home and make dinner while you're watching CNN or MSNBC or PBS or Fox, for that matter, and you are faced with the choice of reading a story about Mayor Brandon Scott here in Baltimore or the DPW or police-involved shootings or the latest information or misinformation about the nuclear strikes in Iran, it's difficult to make that choice. I mean, you want to do all of it, but if you can't do all of it, how does the local news platform compete with the tsunami of news coming out of certainly this White House?
Yeah. I mean, I had long said that the banner would not pursue national news. That was somebody else's job. But the truth is, all of those decisions that Trump has been making over the last 6 months have been very local. So the banner had been finding ways to tell those stories. What does it mean for the tens of thousands of federal workers who live here in Maryland? What does it mean for Johns Hopkins? So finding ways to make local news and national news mesh for the very real impacts for how it affects you, I think, you know, that's how we and many other news organizations have been pursuing this latest round of news.
Kimi Yoshino is a managing editor at The Washington Post. As of Monday, this coming Monday, she was the founding editor of our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, the nonprofit platform, which won a Pulitzer Prize. Juan Manuel Benitez is a professor of professional practice of local journalism at Columbia Journalism School. We might have time for a call or an email or two if you'd like to get involved. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. So Juan Benitez, one of the things that Kimi Yoshino did so successfully at the Banner was collaborate with various partners on events, as well as stories. The story that they won the Pulitzer Prize for was done in conjunction with the New York Times. Are there examples of that kind of collaboration between local news outlets and larger or other partners around the country that you can point to? And do you think that that's going to be key to the future of local journalism?
Of course, that's going to be key. And we see that happening all over the place. I do believe that newsrooms need to share resources. So many times we see national outlets parachuting on a story that is extremely or that is fundamentally local, and they don't really know how to do the job, and they have to go and try to get information from the local reporters who've been reporting in the area for a long time. And that happens when it comes to national elections, when it comes to any kind of news, a big news event. So that kind of collaboration needs to grow for not only local newsrooms to be successful and self-sustainable, but also so national outlets provide higher quality information to their audiences. I do want to say one thing, though, Tom, and before we finish the segment, that this conversation tends to be, when it comes to local journalism, very negative. And I don't want to end this segment without recognizing the job that so many local news reporters are doing all over the country. They're doing their jobs in a very professional manner. They are concerned about the future of journalism, but they are still providing a key service. And among all those local news reporters, I'm sure are your colleagues at WYPR. I do believe that public media is extremely important. And public media, public radio is still providing a huge service to so many Americans all over the country that right now they don't even have a local newspaper anymore. And they are the only way to get information that it really impacts them daily is going to public radio stations like yours.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Juan, and I'm grateful to you. And we're very proud here at WIPR of our news department and the work that they do. And we do collaborate with folks at the Baltimore Banner. Our stories run in the Banner on that website, and the Banner stories run on ours as well. And we have a lot of Banner reporters on shows like this to talk about the work that they're doing. But when it comes to these collaborations, Kimi, I know this isn't your bailiwick. This is not in your portfolio because this is on the opinion side. But there's a plan reported to be in the works at the Washington Post. This is reported by the New York Times. Right now, the internal term for it is Ripple, where they use op-ed pieces, opinion pieces from local papers all around the country, even non-professional writers. Neiman did a story about this. Again, the Neiman group in Boston is a media organization having to do with ethics and best practices. When we start talking about non-professionals being coached by an AI program, because that's one of the ideas that's being bandied about, that makes some people nervous. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to leave the opinion a part of the post to the opinion folks, as you note. I think AI is a powerful tool that can be used for good, but needs to be used strategically and with a lot of guardrails. I don't think it can be ignored.
And what about the notion that, you know, non-professional journalists who are publishing on Facebook and Instagram and TikTok, that's a source for as many as 44%, according to a recent Pew poll, as to where they get their news from. The basic credibility of the legacy media is put in question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that non-professional journalists have written op-eds and letters to the editor that have been published in newspapers for decades. So, you know, I think I would keep that in mind. But it, again, like everything, I think these things should be fact-checked. They should be responsible. We just need to proceed with caution.
Yeah, and Juan Manuel Benitez, when we talk about reinventing media as we've known it, I mean, the old model of a newspaper publishing stories and selling advertisements that appear next to those stories clearly isn't going to work. There are things like events and public gatherings. The Banner did many of those under Kimmy's tutelage these last few years. Is this another trend that we're seeing around the country? I mean, it's more than just publishing stories, isn't it?
It is, and it's always been like that. I think we have to go to the past and to find answers for the future as well. Many news organizations are finding those events to be a great source of revenue at the same time that the ad revenue has been drying up for already decades. So they need to find other ways to sustain the business model, since this is the news business. At the same time, going with what you were talking a minute ago, I think that reporters and local newsrooms, they need to embrace AI. They need to collaborate with AI and make it a tool of their in their daily job. And at the same time, I think we need to embrace influencers. I think sometimes we are very worried about calling it news content, or we look down on influencers. But if we look, go back to the past, we've always had people like influencers who knew how to tell a story in front of the camera. We've had for decades newsreaders on television telling the news, even though many of them weren't even reporters or trained as journalists. So I don't think that everything is that new. I think we need to go to the past to find some solutions that worked in the past now that will work in the future to make the business, the news business landscape sustainable, and also to be able to reach those audiences we need to survive.
Juan Manuel Benitez is a professor of professional practice of local journalism at the Columbia Journalism School. Juan, thank you so much for your time. I'm grateful.
Thank you for having me.
And Kimmy Yoshino is a managing editor at the Washington Post, as the founding editor of our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, the nonprofit platform, won a Pulitzer Prize. Kimmy, we're going to miss you, but we're going to keep reading the Post.
Thank you so much.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, it's Midday with the Mayor, with Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott. And I'll also check in with Maryland Secretary of Labor Portia Wu. And we'll have a theater review with Jay Wynn Russick. She's going to talk about the new show at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. Fresh Air is up next today, a remembrance of the great Bill Moyers. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. We are grateful. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.